And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, now that global warming is no longer something we need to argue about, we can get on with fixing it. But we'd better act fast, because we really need to think about those people who are coming along, the kids today, who will be parents tomorrow with their own kids. What we need now, more than anything else, is to be sure that these kids are raised with the right values about nature and the environment. And that's why today, we feature the 10 most important things for good nature parenting, and a long look at ants. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
This new year kind of reminds me of graduating from high school. Remember when we had scraped our way through the flamboyant ignorance of youth with all of its reckless experimentation and growth and unlimited desires and dreams of amazingness? And then suddenly we found ourselves having to make some decisions on our own, and the whole game changed. I'd known I was going to college from the time I was 5. There was one ad, more than any other, that scared the bejesus out of me. Back then, everything was in black and white on television. And in this ad, there was a picture of a long roadway leading off to a beautiful house on the hill. No special effects here. This was the real thing. And the camera began moving towards the house, up the road towards this beautiful big mansion. And then a powerfully authoritarian voice rose up and said, "The road to tomorrow requires a good education." And then, from the wings of the screen, two giant wrought iron gates began swinging closed until they clamored with a loud metal ka-chung. To get a good life, get a good education. And words appeared that made it clear college was the answer. That worked for me. I instantly became a good student. So college was a given. I'd made up my mind, and that's what I did. I went to the University of Minnesota and got degrees in biology, natural history, and secondary education. And it was up to me to make the most of my education, and here I am, a whole lot of years later, doing what I was trained to do. So when we look at what needs to be done in our future on this planet, we need to prepare ourselves from the time we are young. Well, I can't any longer. But all of us can do the right thing to prepare our kids for the challenges of the future. And here is the rock-solid truth. If nature and all of its attendant charges are to survive, it's going to take the right mix of knowledge, values, attitudes, dedication, and sensitivity. And that's why today I'm going to be talking about the 10 most important things to become good nature parents. If you or anyone you know has young kids, listen or get them to listen. This is one of the most important things we can do for our kids. It really is. So please, listen and pass this on. That's coming up in segment 2 of today's show. But we begin the show with an address about ants. So sit back and enjoy the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and each week I try to bring you an important address about nature and the environment. And today, a special feature about one of the most ubiquitous creatures on Earth, ants. They were here long before us, and will be here long after we become extinct. So now, an address by Deborah Gordon, who studies ants in the Arizona deserts. So now, please welcome Deborah Gordon.
I study ants, and that's because I like to think about how organizations work, and in particular, how the simple parts of organizations interact to create the behavior of the whole organization. So ant colonies are a good example of an organization like that, and there are many others. The web is one. There are many biological systems like that, brains, cells, developing embryos. There are about 10,000 species of ants. They all live in colonies consisting of one or a few queens, and then all the ants you see walking around are sterile female workers. And all ant colonies have in common that there's no central control. Nobody tells anybody what to do. The queen just lays the eggs. There's no management. No ant directs the behavior of any other ant. And I try to figure out how that works. And I've been working for the past 20 years on a population of seed-eating ants in southeastern Arizona. Here's my study site. This is really a picture of ants, and the rabbit just happens to be there. And these ants are called harvester ants because they eat seeds. This is the nest of a mature colony, and there's the nest entrance. And they forage maybe for about 20 meters away, gather up the seeds and bring them back to the nest and store them. And every year I go there and make a map of my study site. This is just a road, and it's not very big. It's about 250 meters on one side, 400 on the other. And every colony has a name, which is a number, which is painted on a rock. And I go there every year and look for all the colonies that were alive the year before and figure out which ones have died and put all the new ones on the map. And by doing this, I know how old they all are. And because of that, I've been able to study how their behavior changes as the colony gets older and larger. So I want to tell you about the life cycle of a colony. So ants never make more ants. Colonies make more colonies. And they do that by each year sending out the reproductives, those are the ones with wings, on a mating flight. So every year on the same day, and it's a mystery exactly how that happens, each colony sends out its virgin, unmated queens with wings and the males, and they all fly to a common place, and they mate. And this shows a recently virgin queen. Here's her wings, and she's in the process of mating with this male. And there's another male on top waiting his turn. Often the queens mate more than once. And after that, the males all die. That's it for them. And then the newly mated queens fly off somewhere, drop their wings, dig a hole, and go into that hole and start laying eggs. And they will live for 15 or 20 years, continuing to lay eggs using the sperm from that original mating. So the queen goes down in there. She lays eggs. She feeds the larvae. So an ant starts as an egg. Then it's a larva. She feeds the larvae by regurgitating from her fat reserves. Then as soon as the ants, the first group of ants emerge, their larvae, then their pupae, then they come out as adult ants, they go out, they get the food, they dig the nest, and the queen never comes out again. So this is a one-year-old colony. This happens to be 536. There's the nest entrance. There's a pencil for scale. So this is the colony founded by a queen the previous summer. This is a three-year-old colony. There's the nest entrance. There's a pencil for scale. They make a midden, a pile of refuse, mostly the husks of the seeds that they eat. This is a five-year-old colony. This is the nest entrance. Here's a pencil for scale. This is about as big as they get, about a meter across. And then this is how colony size in numbers of worker ants changes. So this is about 10,000. Worker ants changes as a function of colony age in years. So it starts out with zero ants, just the founding queen, and it grows to a size of about 10 or 12,000 ants when the colony is five, and it stays that size until the queen dies and there's nobody to make more ants when she's about 15 or 20 years old. And it's when they reach this stable size in numbers of ants that they start to reproduce, that is to send more winged queens and males to that year's mating flight. And I know how colony size changes as a function of colony age because I've dug up colonies of known age and counted all the ants. So that's not the most fun part of this research, although it's interesting. So really the question that I think about with these ants is what I call task allocation. That's not just how is the colony organized, but how does it change what it's doing? How is it that the colony manages to adjust the numbers of workers performing each task as conditions change? So things happen to an ant colony. When it rains in the summer, it floods in the desert, there's a lot of damage to the nest, and extra ants are needed to clean up that mess. When extra food becomes available, and this is what everybody knows about picnics, then extra ants are allocated to collect the food. So with nobody telling anybody what to do, how is it that the colony manages to adjust the numbers of workers performing each task? And that's the process that I call task allocation. And in harvester ants, I divide the tasks of the ants I see just outside the nest into these four categories, where an ant is foraging, when it's out along the foraging trail, searching for food or bringing food back. The patrollers, that's supposed to be a magnifying glass, are an interesting group that go out early in the morning before the foragers are active. They somehow choose the direction that the foragers will go, and by coming back, just by making it back, they tell the foragers that it's safe to go out. Then the nest maintenance workers work inside the nest, and I wanted to say that the nests look a lot like Bill Lishman's house. That is, that there are chambers inside. They line the walls of the chambers with moist soil, and it dries to a kind of adobe-like surface in it. It also looks very similar to some of the cave dwellings of the Hopi people that are in that area. And the nest maintenance workers do that inside the nest, and then they come out of the nest carrying bits of dry soil in their mandibles. So you see the nest maintenance workers come out with a bit of sand, put it down, turn around, and go back in. And finally, the midden workers put some kind of territorial chemical in the garbage. So what you see the midden workers doing is making a pile of refuse. On one day it'll all be here, and then the next day they'll move it over there, and then they'll move it back. So that's what the midden workers do. And these four groups are just the ants outside the nest. So that's only about 25% of the colony, and they are the oldest ants. So an ant starts out somewhere near the queen. And when we dig up nests, we find they're about as deep as the colony is wide, so about a meter deep for the big old nests. And then there's another long tunnel and a chamber where we often find the queen after 8 hours of hacking away at the rock with pickaxes. I don't think that chamber has evolved because of me and my backhoe and my crew of students with pickaxes, but instead because when there's flooding, occasionally the colony has to go down deep. So there's this whole network of chambers. The queen's in there somewhere. She just lays eggs. There's the larvae, and they consume most of the food, and this is true of most ants, that the ants you see walking around don't do much eating. They bring it back and feed it to the larvae. When the foragers come in with food, they just drop it into the upper chamber, and other ants come up from below, get the food, bring it back, husk the seeds, and pile them up. There are nest maintenance workers working throughout the nest. And curiously and interestingly, it looks as though at any time about half the ants in the colony are just doing nothing. So despite what it says in the Bible about, you know, look to the ant, thou sluggard, in fact, you could think of those ants as reserves. That is to say, if something happened, and I've never seen anything like this happen, but I've only been looking for 20 years, if something happened, they might all come out if they were needed. But in fact, mostly they're just hanging around in there. And I think it's a very interesting question. What is there about the way the colony that is organized that might give some function to a reserve of ants who are doing nothing? And they sort of stand as a buffer in between the ants working deep inside the nest and the ants working outside. And if you mark ants that are working outside and dig up a colony, you never see them deep down. So what's happening is that the ants work inside the nest when they're younger. They somehow get into this reserve, and then eventually they get recruited to join this exterior workforce. And once they belong to the ants that work outside, they never go back down. Now, ants, most ants, including these, don't see very well. They have eyes. They can distinguish between light and dark, but they mostly work by smell. So just to reinforce that what you might have thought about ant queens isn't true, you know, even if the queen did have the intelligence to send chemical messages through this whole network of chambers to tell the ants outside what to do, there is no way that such messages could make it in time to see the shifts in the allocation of workers that we actually see outside the nest. So that's one way we know that the queen isn't directing the behavior of the colony. So when I first set out to work on task allocation, my first question was, what's the relationship between the ants doing different tasks? Does it matter to the foragers what the nest maintenance workers are doing? Does it matter to the midden workers what the patrollers are doing? And I was working in the context of a view of ant colonies in which each ant was somehow dedicated to its task from birth and sort of performed independently of the others, knowing its place on the assembly line. And instead, I wanted to ask, how are the different task groups interdependent? So I did experiments where I changed one thing. So, for example, I created more work for the nest maintenance workers by putting out a pile of toothpicks near the nest entrance early in the morning when the nest maintenance workers are first active. This is what it looks like about 20 minutes later. Here it is about 40 minutes later, and the nest maintenance workers just take all the toothpicks to the outer edge of the nest mound and leave them there. And what I wanted to know was, okay, here's a situation where extra nest maintenance workers were recruited. Is this going to have any effect on the workers performing other tasks? Then we repeated all those experiments with the ants marked. So here's some blue nest maintenance workers. And lately we've gotten more sophisticated and we have this three-color system and we can mark them individually so we know which ant is which. We started out with model airplane paint and then we found these wonderful little Japanese markers and they work really well. And so just to summarize the result, well, it turns out that, yes, the different tasks are interdependent. So if I change the numbers performing one task, it changes the numbers performing another. So, for example, if I make a mess that the nest maintenance workers have to clean up, then I see fewer ants out foraging. And this was true for all the pairwise combinations of tasks. And the second result, which was surprising to a lot of people, was that ants actually switch tasks. The same ant doesn't do the same task over and over its whole life. So, for example, if I put out extra food, everybody else, the midden workers stop doing midden work and go get the food. They become foragers. The nest maintenance workers become foragers. The patrollers become foragers. But not every transition is possible. And this shows how it works. Like I just said, if there's more food to collect, the patrollers, the midden workers, the nest maintenance workers will all change to forage. If there's more patrolling to do, so I created a disturbance, so extra patrollers were needed, the nest maintenance workers will switch to patrol. But if more nest maintenance work is needed, for example, if I put out a bunch of toothpicks, then nobody will ever switch back to nest maintenance. They have to get nest maintenance workers from inside the nest. So foraging acts as a sink, and the ants inside the nest act as a source. And finally, it looks like each ant is deciding moment to moment whether to be active or not. So, for example, when there's extra nest maintenance work to do, it's not that the foragers switch over. I know that they don't do that, but the foragers somehow decide not to come out. And here was the most intriguing result. The task allocation, this process changes with colony age, and it changes like this. When I do these experiments with older colonies, so ones that are 5 years or older, they're much more consistent from one time to another and much more homeostatic. The worse things get, the more I hassle them, the more they act like undisturbed colonies, whereas the young, small colonies, the two-year-old colonies of just 2,000 ants, are much more variable. And the amazing thing about this is that an ant lives only a year. It could be this year or this year. So the ants in the older colony that seem to be more stable are not any older than the ants in the younger colony. It's not due to the experience of older, wiser ants. Instead, something about the organization must be changing as the colony gets older, and the obvious thing that's changing is its size. So since I've had this result, I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out what kinds of decision rules, very simple, local, probably olfactory, chemical rules, could an ant be using, since no ant can assess the global situation, that would have the outcome that I see these predictable dynamics in who does what task, and it would change as the colony gets larger. And what I've found out is that ants are using a network of antennal contacts. So anybody who's ever looked at ants has seen them touch antennae. They smell with their antennae. When one ant touches another, it's smelling it, and it can tell, for example, whether the other ant is a nestmate, because ants cover themselves and each other through grooming with a layer of grease which carries a colony-specific odor. And what we're learning is that an ant uses the pattern of its antennal contacts, the rate at which it meets ants of other tasks in deciding what to do. And so what the message is not any message that they transmit from one ant to another, but the pattern itself is the message. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But first, you might be wondering, how is it that an ant can tell, for example, I'm a forager. I expect to meet another forager every so often. But if instead I start to meet a higher number of nest maintenance workers, I'm less likely to forage. So it has to know the difference between a forager and a nest maintenance worker. And we've learned that in this species, and I suspect in others as well, these hydrocarbons, this layer of grease on the outside of ants, is different as ants perform different tasks. And we've done experiments that show that that's because the longer an ant stays outside, the more these simple hydrocarbons on its surface change. And so they come to smell different by doing different tasks. And they can use that task-specific odor and cuticular hydrocarbons, they can use that in their brief antennal contacts to somehow keep track of the rate at which they're meeting ants of certain tasks. And we've just recently demonstrated this by putting extract of hydrocarbons on little glass beads and dropping the beads gently down into the nest entrance at the right rate. And it turns out that ants will respond to the right rate of contact with a glass bead with hydrocarbon extract on it as they would to contact with real ants. So the idea is that ants are coming in and out of the nest entrance. They've gone out to do different tasks. And the rate at which they meet as they come in and out of the nest entrance determines or influences each ant's decision about whether to go out and which task to perform. This is taken through a fiber optics microscope. It's down inside the nest. In the beginning, you see the ants just kind of engaging with the fiber optics microscope. But the idea is that the ants are in there, and each ant is experiencing a certain flow of ants past it, a stream of contacts with other ants, and the pattern of these interactions determines whether the ant comes back out and what it does when it comes back out. And so you can also see this in the ants just outside the nest entrance, like these. Each ant then, as it comes back in, is contacting other ants. And the ants that are waiting just inside the nest entrance to decide whether to go out on their next trip are contacting the ants coming in. So what's interesting about this system is that it's messy, it's variable, it's noisy. And in particular, in two ways. The first is that the experience of the ant, of each ant, can't be very predictable because the rate at which ants come back depends on all the little things that happen to an ant as it goes out and does its task outside. And the second thing is that an ant's ability to assess this pattern must be very crude, because no ant can do any sophisticated counting. So we do a lot of simulation and modeling and also experimental work to try to figure out how those two kinds of noise combine to, in the aggregate, produce the predictable behavior of ant colonies. Again, I don't want to say that this kind of haphazard pattern of interactions produces a factory that works with the precision and efficiency of clockwork. In fact, if you watch ants at all, you end up trying to help them because they never seem to be doing anything exactly the way that you think they ought to be doing it. So it's not really that these haphazard contacts, out of these haphazard contacts, perfection arises. But it works pretty well. Ants have been around for several hundred million years. They cover the Earth, except for Antarctica. Something that they're doing is clearly successful enough that this pattern of haphazard contacts in the aggregate produces something that allows ants to make a lot more ants. And one of the things that we're studying is how natural selection might be acting now to shape this use of interaction patterns, this network of interaction patterns, to perhaps increase the foraging efficiency of ant colonies. So the one thing, though, that I want you to remember about this is that these patterns of interactions are something that you'd expect to be closely connected to colony size. The simplest idea is that when an ant is in a small colony, and an ant in a large colony can use the same rule, like, I expect to meet another forager every 3 seconds. But in a small colony, it's likely to meet fewer foragers just because there are fewer other foragers there to meet. So this is the kind of rule that, as the colony develops and gets older and larger, will produce different behavior in an old colony and a small one, a small young one. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah Gordon. I guess if we had more time, we'd find that you've barely scratched the surface. I have to admit, I have a love-hate relationship with these miraculous little creatures, but I also know that every time I've taken the time to watch them, they've always amazed me. I want to thank TED.com for making this talk available and encourage you to visit their website for great ideas that will change the world. Visit us here each week as we keep you up to date with the world's most important voices for the most important 15 minutes on Earth, here on the Weekly Earth Summit. End this breaking news. Japanese whalers are holding two Sea Shepherd crew members hostage on a whaling ship. The captain of the Japanese whaling vessel Yushin Maru No. 2 is holding two Sea Shepherd crew members from the conservation vessel Steve Irwin hostage. Australian citizen Benjamin Potts and British citizen Giles Lane have been tied to the radar mast of the Harpoon vessel. The captain of the whaling vessel has refused Captain Paul Watson's demand for the release of the crew. The two crew members boarded the whaling vessel with a message to inform them that they were illegally killing whales in the Southern Whale Sanctuary. Sea Shepherd is demanding that Australia and Great Britain demand an immediate release of these two crew members. The letter delivered to the captain of the Japanese whaling vessel stated the following. 2. The captain of any Japanese ship involved with poaching operations in the Australian Antarctic Territorial Economic Exclusion Zone. Sir, my name is Giles David Lane. I am a British citizen and an unpaid volunteer on the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society vessel Steve Irwin. I have come on board your ship because you have refused to acknowledge communication from our ship pertaining to your illegal activities in the waters of the Australian Antarctic Territorial Economic Exclusion Zone. I am not boarding your ship with the intent to commit a crime, to rob you, or to inflict injury upon your crew and yourself or damage to your ship. My reason for boarding is to deliver the message that you are in violation of international conservation law and in violation of the laws of Australia. It is my intent to deliver this message and then to request that you allow me to disembark from your vessel without harm or seizure. I am empowered to act to uphold these laws in accordance with the United Nations World Charter for Nature and the laws of Australia. I am boarding you with the request that you please refrain from any further criminal activity in these waters and cease and desist with the continued killing of endangered whales in this designated whale sanctuary in violation of the IWC Global Moratorium on Commercial Whaling, and that you cease and desist in continued violations of Australian law by killing whales within the territorial waters of Australia without permit or permission from the government of Australia. I am boarding you on the orders of Captain Paul Watson, who requests that you treat me with respect and in accordance with the Geneva Convention. This was followed by confirmation by the Japanese, who said two anti-whaling activists are being held aboard a Japanese whaling vessel in the Southern Ocean. Japan's Institute for Cetacean Research has confirmed. But Institute Director General Minoru Miyamoto has denied the men were tied up. We will be following this story as it develops. And in just a moment, the 10 most important things for good nature parenting when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Give our greed with more than one will ever need. And still we're so blind. Will this be our fate? And we come to understand, oh, creatures on sea and land, before it's too late. Shadows and footprints mirror the movements of moon and tide. Magnificent families glide perfectly calm, nurturing children. Hands, they're part of a perfect plan, and brother to man. Will this be our fate? Can we come to understand, oh, creatures on sea and land, before it's too late?
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, everyone, when you look around outside these days, what don't you see? Kids. Where in the world are they? And that's a big problem, because if kids don't understand that they and nature are intimately codependent, it just may be that one or the other or both of them are heading for, well, I won't say it. But today we bring you the 10 most important things for good nature parenting when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. If you have anything to do with raising children or know someone who does, then listen to this show, or email a link to those who have kids. Something's gone wrong with our relationship with nature. How we got here and why is for another time. But what we can do about it is so important that I'm going to bypass this week's nature news and get right to the point. We must restore our children's natural love of nature. We can. In fact, it's easy, because kids love nature naturally. We see it all the time. Children love animals. They love to watch birds, squirrels, bugs, and butterflies. They like to imitate animals, act like animals, make animal sounds. They love climbing in trees, lifting up rocks, splashing through creeks. Left to their own devices, kids explore and learn about nature every time they go outside. Most of us remember growing up and the free roaming we did. But times have changed, and kids are kept indoors. We all know why. But in fact, it has gone too far. Kids must bond with nature for their own intellectual, emotional, and psychological development, and because in the years ahead, figuring out how to restore the natural world is the most important single challenge they will face. Therefore, we as parents and elders have a responsibility to prepare them. We hold their future in our hands. We are the wise ones. And right now, we need to change some bad habits and make the effort to restore the natural sense of wonder that every child is born with. As a naturalist and educator, I've worked with thousands and thousands of kids, teaching them about nature. And today, I'm going to share my deepest sense of what works best to touch the souls of young people in ways that keep their love of their earth in balance. So, in no particular order, here are the 10 most important things for good nature parenting. 1. Teach a respect for and love of nature. All of these things are important, but this one is the most important. We must, as parents, elders, and friends, demonstrate to our children that we honor living things, that they have worth and value. We must provide a broad sense that we love all of life, which makes up nature, and hold it as a sacred part of being human, to be gentle and kind, and protect all of nature, because it is so very important. There are many ways to do this. From a child's earliest days, when you go outdoors, take a moment to appreciate it. Smile, smell, point out beautiful things and say things like, "I love my earth," or "Isn't this beautiful?" Pay special attention to significant living things in your neighborhood, like special trees. Share with your child the changing of the seasons in ways that show your appreciation for nature's cycles of birth, life, and death. Instill in your child that it is important to treat all of life as sacred. 2. Promote a sense of wonder. Children are born with a natural sense of wonder. They are constantly touching, tasting, shaking, and breaking things to see what happens. This natural desire to learn runs wild in nature. A blade of grass becomes an instrument. A shiny stone makes a child think of bird eggs. Pick up a rock and a hidden community is revealed. Bird poop needs to be dissected with a stick. It's all part of wondering. However, in our shrink-wrapped, safety-obsessed world, children are kept from touching natural things most of the time. They hear parents and others warning them about how these things are dangerous. They are dirty and can make you sick. And quickly, the sense of wonder, so critical to our natural development, dies. You must keep the sense of wonder alive. How? Let kids collect things. Help them collect things. You can help by allowing them to maintain their own collections in odd things like egg cartons and boxes or in weird plastic containers. Treat their collections with respect. When they fiddle with their nature stuff, be curious too, and show your own interest in things you don't know. Let kids get dirty and mucky. They'll live. Weigh the value of chastising them for making a mess, dragging their things into your kitchen, versus rewarding their curiosity with your own sense of wonder. You can teach about not tracking in mud on a rainy day. 3. Show compassion for all living things. Every living thing wants to stay alive and not suffer. If you took a slow-motion close-up of an ant that you're about to squash with your fingertip, you would see that at some moment it would rise up in protest before it dies. Every animal will struggle when caught, because they know that being caught usually leads to their death. They know that. And although we cannot understand how they feel these things, we know that they would rather go about their business of life. Every single creature is a master of his own survival, and that will to live is something that must be honored. It must be acknowledged so that we can grow up as compassionate humans. If we learn to empathize with a beetle, there's a much better chance we will think twice before hurting each other. So anytime you see an animal suffering, share your concern with your child. Show him or her how you care for the creature. If a turtle is crossing a road, yes, if you can, let your child help save the creature from suffering by carefully moving it to safety. If you see an old arthritic dog walking with its master, share with your child how beautiful it is for the dog to still want to be with his master, even though it is in pain. For quite some time, children experiment with animals to see how they react. They pull off wings of flies, not so much to be cruel, but to see what happens. They pull legs off of ants and bugs. Again, not to be cruel, but to see how it affects the way the animals walk. These are natural, and we must honor the child's mind, but at the same time, help the child understand that they can feel the animal resisting and trying to get away because they are afraid of being hurt, and that we don't know how a small bug suffers, but we know that injuries can lead to the death of the animal. These things take time to develop, so be patient. It will pay off. 4. Treat all animals as intelligent and sensitive beings. We have learned a very bad habit from science, and that is to talk of animals as if they cannot think and that their behaviors are strictly responses to their environment, reflexes. I cannot emphasize enough, as a scientist, how absolutely backward this thinking is. For science is beginning to acknowledge that animals figure things out, reason, talk, have emotions, and have very complex social relationships. That's what science informs us. But most people who have animals have a far more generous sense of the intelligence of animals, and they freely talk about it. Animals are capable of doing amazing things, finding their way home over hundreds of miles, flying thousands of miles each year to return to the same nest, building elaborate and beautiful structures like nests, caring for handicapped people, being the eyes for the blind, and more generally, somehow doing all the things that each species does and has no one to do for millions of years, no matter how small, unusual, or powerful they may be. Therefore, raise your children to see the intelligence of animals as they go about their lives. Assume that animals are aware of much of what is going on around them. Inform your children that each animal is an individual. Point out the different personalities of dogs you meet. Some are friendly, some are shy, some are aggressive, some are funny. And help your child to understand that animals are sensitive and that they respond as we do to love, tenderness, kindness, and respect. Show how they need the same kinds of things we need, and they must learn and work hard to get them. Trust me, when children sense the intelligence of the animals around them, their lives will be filled with gifts and wonder. It will provide them with a perception of the truth that will help guide them into a balanced and caring way of life. It will provide them with joy and friendships from the world at large. And it will help them develop the wisdom that animals, forests, oceans, and backyards are teeming with value and worth. Nothing can help them deal with the challenges ahead more effectively. 5. Spend time immersed in nature with no particular mission. Without spending time in nature, children will grow up with a false sense of time. They will not understand the value of being. They will require outside stimulus because they cannot feel the power of life and of this earth that is theirs if they know how to connect with it. We all know how hectic our lives are. We all know as well that even a 3-day trip to another city will extend the sense of time enormously. Kids need to be synchronized with the truth. And nothing speaks the truth like nature. Therefore, you must take the time to allow kids to be in nature with no particular purpose or task or challenge. They need the chance to sense how a day develops, from the morning mists and coolness, to the bird's song and energy, through the midday with its resting, through the afternoon's rich sunlight, and the opening up of the wild creatures, to the evening when the night creatures emerge, to the power of the night with crickets and frogs and strange calls in the darkness. And then it all happens again, the next day, and the next, and the next, and that is so good to know. So go camping, fishing, sitting along riverbanks, exploring, poking around, and in particular, spend time next to a creek on a riverbank for the better part of an afternoon, and together, watch the river flow. 6. Teach intelligent use of nature. As you practice the aforementioned things which you must teach your children, you'll find that naturally a sense of the value of nature emerges, that everything has value, that wasting things really means that somewhere, something has suffered or lost their homes or been killed. And as your child develops as a normal, sensitive person with a sense of the wonder and interconnected spirit of all living things and the value of life itself, a natural economy will develop, a common sense with all of life. Wasting water or food, throwing away things that cost some animals their homes and lives, these things will be felt as irresponsible and hurtful. Therefore, because all living things wish to live as they were designed to live, and that it is a wondrous gift to share the earth with all of these amazing other beings, we damage ourselves when we damage the earth. We destroy our potential joy when we tear down a forest. We lose so many beautiful and spirited creatures when we drain a wetland. We destroy the mysterious balance when we pollute our lands or our lakes and oceans. Children can learn to value the wonder and develop a natural protective spirit, even if it be to protect their own private dream. After all, isn't that what we adults miss so much? The wonder of our youth, the innocence of discovery, the joy in simple things. Help your child learn to save all of these things so that they can unwrap them whenever they need for the rest of their lives. 7. Encourage expression of their findings and discoveries. Children are expressive beings. They naturally sing, dance, smile, cry, run, clap, stare, and ponder. They love to make noise, scream, scribble, paint, and draw. They like to collect and categorize and hide and save special things. Your best job as a parent, elder, or friend is to help them express all of these things. From this, they explore their own inner energetics and are allowed to feel, really feel, what life and being is all about. So when a child appears to want to express their feelings, play with them, have fun, pretend, be silly, forget about being the adult. And through time, your child will become a fully developed person, expressing who they are, how they feel in a spirit of human relationship and friendship, and nothing could be more right. And be sure to read good stories, see good movies, draw and sketch, paint, sing and dance and laugh. And in the end, life will be a better place. 8. Avoid the yucky reaction. This is hard, and we talked about it before, but it deserves another take because it is, after all, our learned response. It is important to unlearn it, suppress it, overcome it, and let it go. What is it? Try to avoid the yucky response. As I've gotten to know and talk with some of the world's greatest nature people, almost without exception, the common thread amongst them all were parents who let them be kids, who allowed their bringing home frogs in jars, bugs in bottles, snakes in sacks, rocks in boxes. For kids inclined to do such things, understand they are developing their scientific and abstract minds simultaneously, because they are collecting the vast, mysterious world of things that they had not known about, and pulling them together to look and study, think about and experiment with their own ideas. This process unites the mind into a coherent reasoning tool that will carry them through life, seeking answers, searching for the truth, and experimenting with new things. For this generation and generations to come, this will be a determinant as to whether they are equipped to deal with the world of tomorrow with reason, strength, and balance. Please allow children to get to know their world on their terms. 9. Allow kids to get hurt as part of their learning. Growing up is filled with hurt. For parents and others, we see children taking frightening falls, coming home with scraped knees, cut fingers, and burned. And yet with a little common sense and the magic healing powers of the body, these things vanish. Becoming a child of the earth will also generate scrapes, cuts, bruises, and bites. But as with falling from a chair in the kitchen or bumping a head on an end table, these too will disappear. So when your child comes inside crying from some adventure outdoors, keep it all in perspective and know that something has been learned about the real world. An element of truth has just been interjected in that little soul, and that it is a requirement of living. And as the demands for children to grow into active advocates for their earth increases, more and more of them will be heading out across the globe to restore rainforests, protect endangered habitats, develop new technologies to offset global warming, battle floods and hurricanes, and deal with whatever it is that global warming, depletion of the oceans, devastation of our mountaintops, diminishing natural resources, and an advancing world population have in store for them. This generation may have to be one of the toughest and strongest on Earth. Help them to learn to be strong. And finally, 10. Spend time in nature where nature dominates. There is an ultimate truth that we all must know. Nature runs this earth. We humans, in all of our reasonable sense of importance, are, in fact, weak compared with the wonder. The most direct means of knowing this is to head on out where nature rules, into backcountry where there are no roads, into the wilderness as far as you can go for days before making your way back. It is invaluable to the soul to be surrounded by wild, filled with bears and hawks and weasels and nematodes, walking on ancient forest beds of quiet needled carpets. And to reach a point where whatever you have with you or within you will determine in reality how you return, and if you will return, to the, quote, real world. A child experiencing this truth with a wise and experienced adult will learn more about life, time, humility, and truth than any single event. They will, in their own ways, meet themselves in ways that only such experiences can engender. And they will meet the Great Spirit, or God, or Yahweh, or Divinity, or however and whatever that is, with nothing to filter the truth. This touch with our most ancient record becomes a silent messenger throughout the days ahead, and will forever enkindle the awe which inspires beauty, peace, and love. These are my personal observations from a lifetime in love with the earth. Please do the best you can. If enough of us do, then our children and their children's children will sit around campfires in deep and wondrous woods and pass on these legends about nature in the good old days.
Nurturing children, why must we kill them with thoughtless hands? They're part of a perfect plan, and brother to man. Will this be our fate? Can we come to understand? Creatures on sea and land, before it's too late.
This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Tuesday or anytime on the archives, when your voice of the earth sails out around the globe here on the Wild Side News.